The following podcast is part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network. Meditation doesn't have to be a solo practice. Meditation is more fun with friends. Looking for a way to drop in and hang out at the same time? Join us online at Omega Institute for a meditation party with self-proclaimed meditation nerds Dan Harris, host of the 10% Happier podcast, Sabine Selassie, and Jeff Warren. This three-day retreat will stream live from Omega's Hudson Valley campus May 17th to 19th. Don't miss the party. Reserve your spot at eomega.org/party today.
Looking for a fun take on modern spirituality? You've come to the right place. From new thought tools to the science behind the metaphysics, dive into interviews with the most interesting people in open spirituality and self-development. It's a big universe, and I'm your host, Jim Lefter. Well, hello, and welcome to Big Universe. It's great to be with you today. I'm Jim. I'm a spiritual journeyman and media consultant type guy. I'm flying solo today, but that's okay. I have my old friend Martha Creek here with me today. How are you, Martha?
I'm doing just fine, and I'm an old friend, and just remembering that your podcast is the Big Universe kind of scares me.
Nothing to be scared about. We're friendly here.
It is a big universe, and I say that my most prominent spiritual practice is to accept the mystery of the big universe. So let's go. Let's dive in here and see what happens.
Perfect. Well, let me read your bio real quick. Reverend Dr. Martha Creek is widely known in New Thought. Her trainings approach deep inner work as an adventure with a sense of curiosity and wonder. A master of the art of right questioning, she calls forth the most stubborn and self-defeating patterns to create a new way of being. Ordained in religious science and divine science, Martha is a member of the Unity Institute faculty. She has attended Emerson Theological Seminary, Byron Katie School for the Work, and Hoffman Institute. She's a healthy congregations facilitator and trainer. See more about Martha at marthacreek.com. Martha is also the author of Presence and Potential, Experience Your Highest Self and Live in Wholeness. Well, thanks, Martha. It's so great to have you here. I very much enjoyed your book.
Thank you for having me here. Listening to that bio, it's like, oh my goodness. And even as I put this little book forward that you just referenced, it's like after 20 some years of this and with a devout practice, I mean, really applying this, it is still amazing to me how much there is left. And as I hear the bio, I thought whoever wrote that about me would not be very attractive for some of your listeners because they don't want their stubborn patterns called forth. Over those, suppress them, depress them, deny them, do anything you can besides call them forth. So that could be scary too, to think about. We're going to be looking at some of our deeply ingrained patterns. I just know for my own sake and my motivations to live more liberated and to be in the world and to be living in the world more liberated, freer, than I had to do it. I tried denial for 20 some years and it wasn't effective for me.
Well, and we do it a friendly way. You do it in a very friendly way. So I don't think people will be too upset about it.
Let's hope so. That's certainly my intent.
So in the bio, you mentioned right questioning. What is right questioning? What does that mean?
Questioning that is looking at what we claim to believe to see, do I actually believe this? So it's questioning really in everything that we claim to believe, any conviction that we have or any belief system, whether it's conscious or unconscious. And many, many examples of it to say that somebody, for example, could say that they want a job. I really do want to get a job. I want to get a job. I want to get a job. And when I ask, what have you done today toward getting a job? Well, I'm going to do my resume. I'm going to look around on Indeed. I'm going to, it's like, okay, well, this is something that you actually believe, but you're not really believing it because you've not done anything toward it. For example, it could be something that we claim that we value education, for example, we're all about education or flying a flag of education, but we've not done something toward our getting our own self educated or more educated, or supporting educational opportunities for others or institutions or places of work or workshops or seminars or things like that. So our values are not in line. It's also right questioning, Jim, are things like today I was working with a lady and she had a traumatic experience on a trip where her daughter didn't show up to meet her as planned. And she really thought she was dead. The girl was dead. And she was in a traumatic response to that, in that that power of the mind to show images of a dead daughter. And she didn't know where she was. She just wasn't where she said she would be. And she was scared. And right questioning could be things like from the work, is it true? Can I absolutely know that it's true? These images, although the mind is tormenting me with these images, can I absolutely know that they're true? And there's no way for me to know that it's absolutely true. So sometimes that can be enough of a pause or enough of a circuit breaker for an overloaded system or a system that's in fear or from a responding from a traumatic, previous traumatic experience, that right questioning can cause us from going any deeper into that pit.
And we've all been there. I mean, in terms of, you know, if you're a parent of any sort or you're close to someone, you know, we've all been to that place where we're like, oh my gosh, this could have happened. This could have happened. This could have happened. And it really is, you talk about pause and pray. And what's your saying there? Pause, pray, and
proceed.
Proceed. That's it. Pause, pray, and proceed.
Martha Creek's three P's. And if you don't pray, you can just put a pause in there.
Yeah.
Or pause, plan, then proceed. Pause, presence myself, and proceed. So something that's going to be that powerful circuit breaker that's going to say, I've got to make sure I'm in a higher seat of consciousness here, that I'm responding to this instead of reacting to this, which is my hardwired, instinctual, knee-jerk, automatic behavior that absolutely runs the show if I don't interrupt it some way, if I don't put a pause in there to say, before I fire off that email or before I let this fear take absolute hold of me, I've got to do something to bring some presence to the situation and to myself so that I can be in this situation, whatever the situation is, differently.
So why did you decide to write this book right now? What instigated the process for you?
This book has been in my teachings for 20 some years. So I didn't sit down and write a book. This was teachings that somebody really recorded and then transcribed and kept saying, this is so good, it ought to be in a book. This is so good, it ought to be in a book. Then it's like, well, put it in a book. So all it really took was gathering up what I've been teaching and referencing. This particular book is 27 practices, 27 chapters, 27 practices that came from one handout that I've been using for years that's founded from my work in family systems theory, the work of early pioneer of Murray Bowen, then Roberta Gilbert and Ed Friedman and the folks at Healthy Congregations use it in leadership training. So that's been very dear to me. And I even say, I don't leave home without this in my bag, that little handout in my bag, because when I get in a boogered up situation, I can look at any one of these things that's outlined here in this little book. Any one of the 27 things is going to keep me calmer, more resourceful, more present, and more apt to respond in a way I'm going to be proud about instead of regretful of. So it was the time. It was time for the book to come out. And it's been stirring and cooking and simmering for years.
Awesome. Awesome. So you mentioned congregation, and you mean more than just a church congregation when you're talking about that. What do you mean by congregation?
Well, it could be anything. You know, this book is not just for ministerial or clergy leaders. This is for a congregation in our family where two or more are gathered. It's a congregation. So it could be a familial unit. It could be our neighborhoods, our workplaces, our office space, this place where I live here. And if you're leading organizations, your team, your business, or congregations, if you are leading a ministry. So it's really where two or more are gathered is what I would mean in that reference to a congregation. And I've used the same material in businesses with leaders and executives and teachers and principals and superintendents and clergy and social workers for years, and just changed the word congregation to organization, or congregation to family, or congregation to marriage. So it's really applicable regardless of what our situation is.
And often we think of, you know, we're with like-minded people, you know, people are, you know, our group is like-minded, but you kind of dispel that. That's kind of delusional. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's like it's a setup. It means that at times we'll be like-minded. At times we agree. At times our thinking is the same. At times our philosophies will be the same. Some of our wants are the same. It also means I cannot fall asleep to the reality that at times I'm not going to think like you do. At times I'm going to have different wants and different needs. I'm going to have different philosophies, different convictions. And this is true in marriages, in families, certainly raising children. They don't want the same things we want. So even though we're cut of the same cloth, we're not like-minded. And you don't have to look outside of your own household to see this. Anybody wouldn't. And then even communities that go together, like businesses, like in our business, we're like-minded. It's like at times we'll be like-minded and it'll look like we're more aligned than we are at times, even because we've also got these patterns running in us where we won't take a stand if it opposes somebody, or we're too afraid to bring a difference into the light because we're afraid of their repercussions, or that they're not going to like us, or they won't include us, or that we'll get fired, in fact, or lose a job, or that I'm going to be upset the family, you know, and cause a big chaos in the family if I really let them know where I stand on a matter. So it's, for me, it's like dispelling the myth that these concepts, like we're like-minded, are actual. They're occasional. There's a spectrum of like-mindedness. And it's not a defined thing. It's not a tick box exercise where we click it off like, oh, we're like-minded here, which is why I tease Jim. I don't think I've ever shared this on your podcast, but I tease, this is why people won't let me do their wedding ceremonies anymore. Do my darndest to dispel it right there at that ceremony. Like, this bliss that you feel and this joy today is one end of the spectrum. And you're going to be mad and blaming and shaming and nitpicking and fault finding. And you're going to be as human as can be here before long. And what you're saying yes to is the whole person, not the part you get when you get what you want.
And when dealing with other people, we have to define ourselves to some extent, but we don't want to disassociate from them. How do you navigate that? How do you define yourself and still be in a place where you can accept other people for who they are? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, just as simply as you said it, like, I've got to work at keeping my own convictions cared for and clarifying what my convictions are, and to be as open and interested to understand what your convictions are and where you stand. So I cannot displace my convictions and preferences onto you and not erode our relationship. So in order for me to be in an honest, authentic, sustainable relationship, I've got to disclose what I think and believe and where I stand, share my values, what I'm about, and be just as willing for you to stand where you stand and have the values and convictions that you have. I don't have to agree with them. I don't have to like them or love them. I don't have to vote for them. And I've got to accept that you are wired the way you are, have the beliefs and convictions you do, and I have my own. And I can still be in a relationship with you and not have to make you come my way or make myself abandon my own soul and self to go toward you.
Okay, so we're wading into some interesting territory. What about politics? And we're dealing with, you know, we're dealing with family members or other folks that are, you know, at the opposite end of the spectrum. How do I navigate that?
Well, there's no formula for it. And I just did a podcast, the Spiritual Forum podcast, and she talked a lot about this because she was airing it as it came up on Thanksgiving. So it was like how I can go be with my opposing polarized family and not lose my peace of mind and not to turn the tables over, not to get up and stomp out or do whatever we're kind of wired to do. So no formula for it. I can tell you what I've witnessed that's been effective. I can tell you what I've been able to do in my own circles with close friends of lifetime friends and friends of decades, as well as my own direct and immediate family members. And that is to seek to understand where their thinking is, to seek to understand why they stand where they stand, what's it about, what's it for. And in every single case where I do that, I can relate. Even though I don't agree with it, even though I'm not going to support it, I can absolutely, there's not been one time where I couldn't understand where they're coming from. And in the case with my brother, my one living brother, he was anti-vaccination and I was going to get a vaccination. And I had just determined we're so polarized on this, I wasn't going to mention it to him. Mm-hmm. It was something that we clearly don't agree on. So I would then not even open that up as a point of conversation because I know it's not going to go well, that it's going to be tense. And I don't want to live my life where I've got to avoid things like that. I don't want to live as a prisoner of that. So I can make a discerned choice about how much I'm going to share or when or who with. And I can also, in this case, I just said casually, What are you doing this afternoon? And I said, I'm going to do this, this, and this, and go over and get a vaccination, a COVID vaccination. And there was dead quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I know that you don't agree with this. I know that you're anti-vaccination. And I accept that about you. And I'm going to go get one. And he said, I'm afraid the vaccination will hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm afraid not getting the vaccination will hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
So our thinking was the same. And it was based on my care for him and his caring for me. And I never would have got to that if I hadn't have been willing to open up that conversation and to let him know where I stood on it and that I accepted where he stood, that I would not put my way off onto him. I will not try to coerce or will my way onto him. And I'm not open to him trying to coerce me. And he didn't. He hasn't.
With politics, do we sometimes have to take a stand? You know, if there's some sort of injustice that appears to go on between us, what are your thoughts on how we navigate that? If we feel like there's something that, you know, that needs to happen in our society that you feel strongly about and still be willing to listen to the other side, what would you say we do to navigate that?
Well, again, there's no formula and everybody's answer will be different. I just know that I can't bring justice to injustice by bringing more violence into the world.
Yes. So
hateful and dug in and rigid and close-minded that I get, the more violence I've just put in the world, even in the name of peace, or I'm a peacemonger, but I'm not a peacemonger if I'm hating warmongers. Mm. So the more I hate warmongers, the more hate and war I've put in the world. So I definitely would take a stand. I would say, this is what I think about a matter. This is where I stand on it. I will not support certain things. I will support certain things. And then in integrity to myself, I have to take action to support what I claim to believe. And that's the only justice I can ever bring. And I've read a poem twice already this month on air, and I'm reading it again in a public service on Sunday about this, that I can't stop bullets. I can't stop widows. I can't stop wives from becoming widows. I can't stop tanks from barreling down a street. So what can I do? So I can do different by whoever shows up in my life today. Do different by how I'm going to respond when I don't get my way. I can take down all the war I can within me, and then look at what I think is causing war in the external, and take sane, sensible action toward all the prevention I can do. Be it stating a cause, being it supporting a cause, the way I vote, where I send money, who I support to, things like that. And that's plenty. If we would all do that part, it would be plenty toward ending some of this war that we've got, and this divisiveness, this polarization, or whatever, ever how you frame it, with what's going on in the world, in the way of politics and religious beliefs, and how we're going to be with these differences.
So, in continuing with this, you know, we all have buttons that we allow people to push. We have, you know, there are these hot button issues that, you know, especially family know how to get to you at times. How do you deactivate those buttons? How do you, you know, remove the, you know, the shock of it, or the experience of it?
Well, over time, you know, looking at what's causing that, the fact that I have a trigger, and you're right, they were installed with the family. So naturally, then the family is going to be the one that tap dances on them. So I'm going to be then predictably more triggered in the family, because that's where the traumas and the triggers went into place. So the triggers are normal. They're part of my human learning processes. And I want to live caring for these triggers. So I've gone back personally to look at what happened that caused me to think and feel and react so intensely to something as I did. And I've been in healing work for decades now, 30 years of this, really all my life to some degree, and professionally for this coming up on 30 years, to look to see at what happened back there, what happened to you, what happened to me that caused me to take on the beliefs that I did. And the fear of the feelings that I have, which is really what the triggers usually are, some aspect of us, some part of us steps in like a firefighter to say, I'm going to make sure you don't feel that anymore. And now they just stepped on your last doggone nerve. So now war is on. And then we instinctually go into a patterned response to shut down, get quiet, cut off, leave the room, flee, or go after them. Like, I'll show you. So conflict, basic fight, flight, and freeze, and throw in a little fawning and frenzy and feeding and other F words. that is what happens when our triggers get pulled or pushed. And it's a lifetime of work to figure out what they are. They're mostly subconscious. It's not obvious. Like today, most of the sessions I did with people today went, I had this big response. It didn't even make sense. I had a big reaction to something. Like, it made no sense. Like, I was having just a perfectly kind of normal day, and then something happened and I wasn't okay anymore. So these are to be dealt with, you know, depending on what course of study you're in. Every sage and seer has said it's not a question of if you're going to do this, just when, and how painful it's going to have to get. And I personally want to be pulled by possibility, pulled by potential, more than I want to be pushed by pain.
Oh, I love that.
So pulled by vision, pulled by potential. Instead of pushed by the pain of it. So that keeps me at it. And I take criticism for it. I hear it about every week or two with, my God, you just keep digging and digging and digging. It's like, I do. I'm excavating and I'm going for whatever put that wire, that tap root that put that wire in place. It's like, I'm working to take out the root when possible. And when not to, as your words was, to deactivate it, to get it more neutralized so that I don't have to live my life like a minefield. And I don't want to have to tippy toe around other people in their minefields either.
Now, so it goes back in a way when you're something is triggered in the moment, it goes back to the pause, pray and proceed again, you know, to some extent, so that you have the choice of how you're going to respond when you take that moment. Is that right?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Pause, nothing can go wrong in a pause. So a pause has real potential that says, I'm going to, at least if I pause, I've just intercepted that low part of my brain that takes over. That is that knee-jerk, habitual, instinctual response. So just pausing is likely going to be enough for me to at least access cognition to say, what would a sane, sensible action be here? Mm-hmm. How do I want to respond to this so I'm not so reactive to this? So just asking, taking a pause and asking one question, because the cognition is accessed if we ask one question. Is this actually true, what I'm believing? Or what would be the consequences if I don't pause and think about this? And then how do I want to be in this relationship? Mm-hmm. How do I want to show up in the world? What is my integrity here? And what am I going to likely regret if I don't take a pause here and respond to this instead of react? So it's possible at times. It's not always possible, because we've got this knee jerk is very real. Just like if we touch a hot stove, we don't think, oh, let me get my hand off this. When we hit that hot stove, the hand comes off.
Yeah.
This is what we're dealing with. And psychologists for years have had all sorts of approaches to this. Carl Jung believed that we could will ourselves out of this reaction, for example. Mm-hmm. And he, in his studies, and this is put forth in writings, he could see intellectually, he had a little snake in a plexiglass box, in a small plexiglass container. So his intellect could see there's no harm here. There's no way this snake can harm me. And he was going to will himself out of that knee-jerk reaction. And guess what happened? Every time he put the snake up here, and the snake did what a snake does, even though I can see intellectually I'm not at risk, there's no actual threat here, the body mind is not caught up.
Does everybody have a sense of trauma in their lives? Has everybody experienced trauma?
I think so, honey.
Yeah.
And on how you define it, I mean it's every key word. You can't search anything now without seeing the word trauma in it. And it's typically in the past, it was more related to atrocities, something absolutely malicious. And it's now the science shows that it could be something that somebody that today, one of the women was one single time in her life, everybody got in the car and drove off and she was left standing there.
Mm-hmm.
Them a little bit to realize she's not in the car.
Mm.
So trauma. Somebody else watched her little brother get hit by a car.
Oh my goodness.
He lived.
Yeah.
And was traumatized by that because of she was responsible for him in her. So his getting hit by the car was her fault. She was at fault because of that.
Hmm.
So, and we've all experienced something that left us panicked, not feeling safe, not feeling okay. Like we didn't have value, unseen. I mean, just on and on and on. So depending on how your audience defines trauma, but every one of us has had something happen to us where we were shook loose.
But it's important not to be the victim, not to feel like you're the victim of everything, of life, you know, and that can be challenging when you have a traumatic event. You feel like, oh, this happened to me. It's not my fault. It happened to me. How do you get out of that victim mindset?
Well, to accept that some won't, that mm-hmm. it's not for everybody. It's just for how am I going to get out of the victim mindset? Because then if I'm not careful, I'm victimized of their victimization. Just like I criticize their criticizing, or I judge their judgmentalness, or I complain about how much they're complaining, the irony of it, versus for me to come out of my own victimization. And there's a chapter in the book on that, which is to keep my focus and more lean to on what can I do in this situation. And it's the difference between, oh, I've lost my job, what am I going to do? And I've lost my job, what am I going to do? And then going toward that instead of going deeper into, I'm the one that's lost her job. I'm the one that doesn't have a job. I'm the one that was wronged. I'm the one that always gets the short end of the stick. I'm the one that life's after. I can't win for losing. And there's such an allure, as ridiculous as it sounds, there's such an allure to that, why me, poor pitiful me, victim, look what's happened again, which is underpinned and wired in there with life is against me. Life is hard and I can't. So it's no little thing in any situation, any one situation, to say I've lost my job and there's something I can do about it. I've lost my job and I'm going to go do something about it. Versus I lost my job and now I'm going to take on a persona and the identity as the one who's lost her job and then beat that drum all the way to my grave. And there's a real allure to it. And it sounds like, oh no, like who would want to do that? That's such a drag. But there's such power in the mind of doing it. Just like today, I've used this in many talks and teachings. Like if you go out to get in your car and the tire's flat, it's like, oh, brother, the flat tire, like after all I've done for God, this is such an inconvenience. Like the tire's at fault, the car people's at fault. And then there's a part of us that can say, what would a sane, sensible person do here? It's like, oh, flat tire, and I want it inflated, so what would I do? Inflate the tire, call AAA, get a neighbor. Like the mind is open to go and get this solved and to solve it quickly. Then we get the tire solved, the tire's inflated again, we're good to go. And that's all we'll talk about for the rest of the doggone day. It's hey, true. Martha, how was your day? Well, everything was just fine. I was just fine until I went out and I had a flat tire. I can't even believe it. I mean, my whole life has been one big flat tire.
Jeez.
I go to work on Monday. And it's like, hey, Martha, how was your weekend? Well, awful, because I had a flat tire right in the middle of the day and it caused me an inconvenience and it caused me to miss something. And we just talk and talk and talk it to death. What happened? Instead of backing up from that and seeing the miracle of, I am 63 years old. I've been driving since I was 13. 50 years of rubber with air in it, on an axle, spinning at high speeds, in a car, in all sorts of weather, bumpy roads, potholes, sliding, hot, 120 degrees, 10 below 0 degrees. And out of that whole 50 years, 5 experiences of flat tires.
So it's about perspective.
Gaining perspective, yes. And when I lose perspective, then I'm going to slip off right into that victim mentality again. Instead of, it was inconvenient, I don't like it, I don't love it. And no sane person that I know is going to jump out and go, oh, goody, goody, it's a flat tire, yay, rah, rah. But it's like, this is a flat tire. And if I get a period in there, it's a flat tire, period. Instead of, it's a flat tire, comma, oh, that's a real inconvenience. Or this is a mess, or this shouldn't be happening. Or, oh, brother, it always happens to me, because all the hell's after the comma. So if I can get a period in there, I'm not going to go as far down here. And then I can back up and say, wait a minute, let me get some perspective here, which could also be very handy when we're dealing with people. If you did something that hurt my feelings or got on my nerves or offended me, and I go, no, wait a minute, I've known Jim for how many years? 15 years? And we've been in some big conversations and big universe conversations and things about growing businesses and closing businesses and all sorts of other things. And I've not had that experience with Jim before. So this is not characteristic for Jim.
Mm-hmm.
So then I'm more apt to keep my connection with you. I'm more apt to have compassion for you. And to see with a little perspective, I'm not going to let the one incident that we have take over our relationship.
Mm.
I'm not going to make you the devil because you didn't show up to suit me mm-hmm. in one situation.
Mm-hmm. So you had an experience of breast cancer in which you had to identify how you related to life. Tell me a little bit about that experience. It's I think in line with what they're talking about here, having that experience and then, you know, deciding how react to it.
Well, to start with, I didn't have the reaction that I would have imagined I would have. If you'd have shown me a clip of your life and said, now up the road, Martha, you're going to have some breast cancer and you're not going to have a big reaction to it, I wouldn't have been able to believe you. But that was actually my lived experience. Like you and I didn't have history of breast cancer. I've not had pregnancies. I've not had hormones. We don't have it in the family. I mean, it was so outside of the norm of how this breast cancer runs. So I had some immediate disbelief, but not out of denial, but out of really like, I didn't have any of the factors for this. So it was more of a curiosity about this. And then it was, the same thing I'm saying here on your interview, what am I going to do about this situation? And it's like how I choose to be with this situation is going to create my experience of this situation. So I'm going to do my best not to create more trauma to myself and more drama in my life. So it's like right off to the experts I go, what is it? What degree is it? What are you going to do about it? What do you recommend about it? And then I discerned what they said. I was already pretty clear when I went in for that oncology and surgery appointment. I was already clear about what I was going to do. Even though it was early stage breast cancer, I was going for a mastectomy. That's what was clear for me to do. And I had many friends. I've had many, many friends, hundreds of friends that had breast cancer. And most of them had lumpectomy instead, and I was mastectomy. And when I got in there, the surgeon was clear that you're here to have a mastectomy. So I didn't have to like vie for that or defend my choice or anything. We were in perfect alignment about that.
Mm-hmm.
I then, just like I did with the flat tire, I backed up and said, okay, let me look at the full spectrum of illnesses people have in the world. Diagnosis, diseases. And I have lived this many years, 50 years at that time, thereabouts, healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Generally healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So you won't hear me complaining about a little breast cancer.
Mm.
Period.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like one of the quotes. Quoting you in the book, you say, life is doing what life does. How we relate to life is up to us. I love that. I think that's really emblematic. That's really important.
Well, that's an example of it. And mm-hmm. there's this delusion that there's no disease in the world or that I'm immune from disease. It's like build all the immunity you can. Do everything in the world you can do to build immunity. And then one day when it's your turn, when it's our turn to have whatever we're here to have, then the immunity is got to be rebuilt. So it's not a tick box exercise, but a direction to go in. And just like rain and weather and hurricanes and flood and drought, Nobody wants a drought. Nobody wants a flood, and they're included. And nobody wants a disease, mm-hmm. and they're included. Nobody wants the diagnosis, and they're included.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My experience of them is going to be based on how I approach it. And if the broader perspective I hold and the more solid ground I keep myself on with what I can do in this situation, what I can do about this, instead of poor, pitiful me, and ain't it awful? Even with the allure and the tendency to awfulize, this is awful, awful, awful. And there's enough awful to go around, and it's awful enough without me putting more awful on me.
Mm-hmm. When we're dealing with issues and when we're dealing with other personalities and things in general, you talk about there comes a place where sometimes we have to accept solitude, you know, we're going to make our stand alone. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, that it's very, very scary. Met anybody that's really masterful at this, that says the sages, the seers, the teachers, I mean, people that we're all likely reading books from have done this to some degree, that says, I'm going to have to accept when I take a certain stance, or when I come out of the closet about a certain thinking or the way I am, that I'm not going to be popular. In some cases, I'm not going to be respected. I'm actually going to be disrespected, disregarded. I'm going to be excluded. I'm going to be cut off from. And I've got to be willing to bear that. In order for me to live a life of integrity to myself, I've got to do what I'm responsible to do here on the earth, what I think I'm here to do. I'll do it the best I can to not erode relationships and displace and make other people wrong that can't think the way I do or believe the way I do. I absolutely accept that. And I've got to accept that there's going to be things that I do that are not popular with some, and that I will definitely be excluded from certain people, certain invitations, certain organizations that just wouldn't align with me, and that it's not fatal. It's uncomfortable and not fatal. And this notion, and I'm a little guarded about that. Even as I read the book yesterday, as I was telling you and putting it on video to use down the road, to be very clear that I'm not recommending solitude. Mm-hmm. So the same thing, solitude that's very helpful to me, that helps me clarify my thinking and reflect and gain insight and perspective, could absolutely put somebody else in a psych ward.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are not okay in solitude. They're not okay with their own thoughts,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which are not their thoughts either,
mm-hmm.
but they're not okay with thoughts and the stream of thoughts. So this is not a recommendation of solitude. This is for me a demonstration that in this particular life, my own life, I've got to have some solitude, times of silence, times of quiet, times of pulling back, going to the desert, go to the mountain, go wherever you can go to gain some perspective and a broader perspective and some insight, and to accept that solitude will be part of my life's journey, that there's going to be times that I will be excluded from certain things in certain people's lives.
And it's important to live by your own goals and not other people's expectations. I mean, you talk about this obviously in the book, but you know, our society, we follow up what we're supposed to do. We think we're supposed to do in our society, and we wind up into a place sometimes where it's like, did I even really want this? I wondered if you might talk a little bit about your goals versus other people's goals and their expectations.
Well, you just laid it out, Jim. That's exactly what happens. Like, we're going along with traditions, with expectations. We're going along with pressures, coercion, willfulness, stubbornness. We're going along with achieving, however we're driven to get success or to be a somebody. Often without regard to, do I actually care about this? Does this actually interest me? So if we don't stop and ask these kind of powerful questions, the right questions and right questioning, then I just keep something going that's absolutely not true for me. And if when I personally do it, it sucks the very life out of me. It really does dispirit me. My well-being declines. I'm not in a well-being state. I also will eventually start to resent it. I'll start to resent what I'm doing, which is a blatant sign that I'm out of integrity with myself. And there's plenty of opportunities for it. And we had my mother, thank goodness, was not as much of a traditionalist. So we would talk about what we're going to do at Thanksgiving or Christmas and family holidays and things, and what was meaningful to her. And she was a workhorse. I mean, she worked and worked and worked for years, decades, 7 days a week sometimes. And we had to have holidays at different times based on a work schedule because that was her priority. And it's very similar to me. I'm very much like it. And while she was alive, I said to my family, really, as we sat at a table, a family table at the holiday, really soak this up. Because if she dies before I do, I will not be doing this. I am not going to be cooking everything that's not nailed down and working at this for 3 or 4 days for a 20-minute meal that most people don't appreciate anyway. I'm not going to do it. It's not true for me. Now, I'll buy you a meal. I'll have one catered. I'll bring one in. I'll do a lot to keep us together in this way, but I'm not going to do this. So it's like saying, even though that was the tradition, that's not mine. That's not true for me. I'm also in a family that didn't really value education. They thought it was dumb. They couldn't understand why people would go. Nobody's better off, you know, going to college or anything like that. And I wanted to go to college. I had a deep desire for education and just determined as a kid, I was going to figure out a way to go regardless of what I had to do. So I went and found a way to go to college, and I excelled in school and got good grades. And then I went on to college, and I didn't do so traditionally. I've never lived on a college campus. So, and my family didn't support it. They didn't have any ways of doing it. I didn't have anybody to underwrite me going to college or to pay for it. So I got some scholarship at the beginning, and then I worked 3 jobs and went to college because it was important to me. And it means that I'm different. It's another way that I'm different from my family, but it was a way for me to take care of my own integrity. What's important to me, it doesn't have to be important to them. I can absolutely understand their thinking, and they were right. They turned out just fine without education, and it was important to me.
So that's how one of the ways that you define yourself. And this is something that all of us can do. We can make the choices that we need to make based on what we feel is the right path for us.
And only us. So making the choice for what's right for me, and then not shaming my family because they don't do it. Or hating my family because they don't do it. It's like they get to do them, I get to do me. And my responsibility is to do me and to live in as much authenticity and integrity as I can because of how much I value it. And I'm as devoted not to put my way off onto other people. This was my way of doing it. It's not the right way to do it. Yours is not the wrong way to do it. We are on a full spectrum of human beingness here. Just like the trees and just like the flowers, we're all a big bouquet. We're all a species, and we're all very different. And I don't get to be a rose and try to make a rose out of you if I'm a tulip. So instead, I'm going to be the best tulip I can be and have the life of a tulip instead of being mad that I wasn't a rose and then taking that all the way to my grave. And instead of like, I'm going to do the very best I can to align myself with what I value, what I want to see more of in the world, what I want to create, what I want to uplift. And it's a full-time job. And there's a lot of allure to be like the Joneses.
Yep. It is a full-time job. That's for sure. That's for sure. Well, as we wrap things up here, I wondered if you might have one final piece of advice you'd like to give our listeners before we go. That's not a loaded question, is it? That's not a challenging thing to say.
Well, no, there's so much that I want to say, Jim. It's striking, really. So some of this is right in the book. These are some of the favorite Martha-isms. So I'll just share them here. When you notice the horse is dead, dismount.
I like that.
It has saved me so many times when I keep beating my head against a brick wall, trying to get this dead horse to get up and go again, trying to breathe life into a dead horse. Like, oh, this is actually a dead horse. Let me get off of this horse. That's what I can do. That would be sane and sensible. The next thing that's been the most powerful to me, one of the most powerful things is, and somebody just handed this back to me in a dose yesterday. You cannot make a bean plant grow by pulling on it. So, and my favorite thing to close with is you're not alone. There's no one that's alone. You don't have to do this life alone. You'll have to do parts of it alone, but not most of it. No, you don't have to go about it alone. You cannot do it wrong. You cannot do it wrong. There's no such thing. And it's going to take longer than you like.
Love it. I love it. Well, Martha, it's been such a pleasure having you back on Big Universe. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me back. I've looked forward to it ever since you called me.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, find out more about Martha Creek at marthacreek.com and get her new book, Presence and Potential, Experience Your Higher Self and Live in Wholeness. You can also find Martha on YouTube. Martha Creek. Look it up. We'll talk to you next time. This is Jim Lefter. I'm happy to be here with you, and I'll see you next time on Big Universe.
Do you want to deepen your connection to the divine? Speed up your progress on the spiritual path? Then tune in to the Spirit Matters podcast. I'm the host, Philip Goldberg, and I interview experts with wisdom, insight, and practical guidance for every seeker of truth. Spirit Matters on the MindBodySpirit.fm network. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.